Greater Sandton and beyond. Get ready for the Sandton Times Hour.
With your host,
Alexander.
Ladies and gentlemen, everyone in between and beyond, those who are load shed and those who are about to be load shed. It's 2 p.m. in Rio de Janeiro, 6 p.m. in Barcelona, 1 a.m. in Kuala Lumpur, and 2 a.m. in Seoul. And wherever you are, this is the Sandton Times Hour on Mix 93.8 and also available on all good digital audio platforms. I'm Alexander Leibner, and this is edition 146. It's week 8 of 2024, and we totally forgot to mention Happy Valentine's Day and also wish everyone a Happy Valentine's Day. So here it is. Happy Valentine's Day. A belated one, but one filled with lots of love, and we'll make up for it in the next hour. If you'd like to get in touch, you can do so by sending through your questions, your comments, or your feedback, and you can do so on a myriad of channels. You can email editor@sandtontimes.co.za. You can connect on social media @SandtonTimes, and you can also visit the website sandtontimes.co.za. And if you're listening live on Mix 93.8 right now, and not at a later stage on one of the podcast platforms, well, you can do so and get in touch using the WhatsApp line 0848220938, 0848220938. And as always, a special welcome to everyone listening for the very first time. If this is the first time that you're tuning in, you've come across the show in some way or another, well, welcome to you. And of course, all our regular listeners, part of the Sandton Times Hour Nation in Johannesburg and Pretoria, across South Africa and everywhere else in the world. If you're listening online or on air, wherever you are, I'm happy to report that all is well in Sandton land. And Vincenzo, thanks for reminding me about Valentine's Day, by the way. Here we are chatting away last week, and we totally missed it. We got so wrapped up in all the other content, but I do appreciate the chocolates you brought. Did you buy those on discount the next day after Valentine's Day? Because I had a feeling I saw a sticker that said markdown. It's a thought that counts, right? Okay. All right. Well, I'll still enjoy it. Thank you so much. And we also got some listener feedback. Thanks for reminding me about that, actually. We did get some feedback last week, which I just wanted to mention. We spoke about the state of the nation, of course, and how people making plans around load shedding, because it just continues unabated. It just never ends. Sometimes it's low, sometimes it's high. It's become so part of our regular life. Somebody even mentioned the other day, they were saying, you know, they've got a kid who's 18 years old. He doesn't know a world without load shedding. Like, their reality has been 18 years of load shedding. Like, to say there was a day or a time when there was no load shedding almost seems like a mythical story. So here's Mike, who wrote in, who said, enough is enough, but I make plans where I can. I've got a gas geyser, a gas stove, which is a hob and an oven, two portable battery backup LED lights, batteries that last about 1.5 hours, rechargeable LED bulbs in the kitchen and bathroom, inverter UPS, which runs electronics like the computer, printer, router, etc., and emergency phone charging, but also batteries, which are only lasting about 1.5 hours, and they're hugely expensive to replace. So at the highest stages, which is what, like stage 5, 6, 7, that's it. Cannot use it in those stages. But he says it is what it is, and I'm better off than many, so I still feel very blessed, which is very much a glass half full approach. And Mike, I hear you. Don't we all, especially if you work from home quite a bit, you have to make those plans, otherwise you become completely dysfunctional. But it is an expensive exercise, and like you say, there's so many people who don't have that option. If you still have the option to spend the money and make a plan, then like you said, you're one of the privileged. But if you don't have that option, then it is really a difficult and frustrating time to have to go through. Yeah, once again, don't forget to register for the elections if you haven't done so yet. Friendly reminder. Then there's Lizelle, who wrote in, and she said, I enjoy this honest discussion from Boosie. That was the conversation we had last week with Business Leadership South Africa, a reaction and a response to the State of the Nation address that we heard. Apart from that, we had a very good week in the Sandton Times diary. Managed to attend the launch of Chock's Flip Flop Day, which I also didn't mention last week, which is coming up on the 23rd of February. And for 10 rand, not only does it give you a sticker, but it also gives you the privilege of wearing slip-slops to work. So if you rock up in slip-slops or flip-flops or whatever you want to call them at work, you can tell your boss, well, I've got my sticker, I've done my bit, and I'm helping Chock do some very important work in the field of childhood and teenage cancer management. You know, they can't cure it, but they can certainly try and make life a little bit easier for those families who are facing the horrible, horrible predicament of cancer. And in some instances, they fight the fight and see it through. In other instances, unfortunately, they do lose that fight. But CHOC tries whatever they can to try and ease that with all kinds of support mechanisms. And Flip Flop Day is one of their massive fundraisers to keep that entire mission going. Then also headed to Mama Samba this week. Mama Samba, a very popular sort of Latin-inspired restaurant in the heart of Rosebank. They launched their Carnival, which is sort of a two-week festival at the restaurant. And it features some exquisite tapas, some great Latin sounds, and exquisite cocktails. So if that all sounds very tempting to you, well, make sure you pop onto the Santon Times website, put all the details up there if you want to check out the Mama Samba Carnival. I see Mikasa's performing, Lemon and Herb, and a whole bunch of other great artists, also some DJs, some live performances, and I must say the food was exquisite. It was divine. And yeah, good vibe, and it might be something you might want to check out. So coming up on this week's show, Budget Day 2024 is coming up this week, and I catch up with the CEO of a leading institution to get a temperature of what we can expect and how it might or might not affect our pockets. Then a new ready-to-eat food franchise is coming to South Africa, and I chat to the CEO spearheading this expansion to get some more details and the full story of that coming up shortly. Then I'm joined by a seasoned motoring mind to chat about the finalists in this year's Car of the Year competition, and details coming up there. And finally, there's a major comedy festival heading to Sandton, and I caught up with the creative director this week to get all the details for you. So it's a jam-packed hour, but time for a bit of music as we kick things off. And seeing as we missed a touch of Valentine's this past week, here's one of my favorites. It's Michael Bublé with You're the First, the Last, My Everything. This is the Santon Times Hour on Mix 93.8.
Promote your brand. Advertise your business.
Our audience could be your next client. Contact the Santon Times today. The best of talk and music in 1 hour. This is the Santon Times Hour.
This is the Santon Times Hour on Mix 93.8 and also available on all good digital audio platforms. Well, big week ahead. One of the big weeks of the year ahead, at least. It's Budget Day, and I know there's some people who avidly follow Budget Day. It's like the South African equivalent to the Super Bowl in the United States for people in economics and finance and in all things tax. And for other people, they don't even know the Budget Day happened. They just sort of get the summary. They check if the cigarette price went up, if petrol's going to cost more, if their glass of favorite white wine is going to be a little bit more than it was the year before. And that's all they worry about. So this year, I think it's going to be a little bit different. And here to chat to me about that is Professor Keith Engel. He's the CEO of the South African Institute of Taxation. And Professor, we've spoken before. It's good to have you back on the Santon Times Hour.
Good to be back, and I appreciate the honor.
Well, Professor, let's kick things off with your general impressions of what you think Budget Day 2024 is going to look like. What is Finance Minister Enoch Gonongwana going to have to deal with?
Look, I think the biggest issue is that our deficit is continuing to go against us. So the problem is debt. And how do you deal with that debt, yet you still want to satisfy the constituency that you have? And most of that constituency wants grants. So the real problem is it's really about fiscal control. And then the issue is, well, do we raise taxes or not within that paradigm? Now, again, Kieswetter and the SARS has gone beyond what was expected. So they're beating target. You know, which way to handle that? Do we cut? Do we just hold back? Do we raise taxes? It's a traditional problem that he has, but because it's an election year, it's now exacerbated. And we've also fallen behind where we were. I think COVID really hurt us on our debt numbers, and we haven't recovered, and that trajectory doesn't seem to be improving very much.
Is the decision to focus on things like improving SARS, improving collection, bringing in technology to try and, you know, digitize the whole system rather than hiking taxes, is that also part of the sort of pre-election sort of strategy, not to sort of upset, you know, people too much? You know, when you start grabbing their pockets, you know, people generally don't react very well.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. Look, in any election period, I mean, we might not think so, but we actually are a democracy. And you don't want to be raising taxes in election year. So there's always this discussion, VAT, you know, are they going to raise the VAT? There is no way they're going to raise the VAT this year, unless they actually want to lose the majority, because if you hit the VAT, you're hitting their supporters. The other one that's fearful is, well, if you can't hit the VAT, let's hit the rich. The problem is you can't get enough out of the rich fast enough. So that doesn't really work. So really what you're hearing, and it's a strategy that's been going on about 4 years now, is that we need to collect more from the people who aren't paying their legally required amount. So this is where Keyswetter has been very good, is that we've talked in years past where we just go after the honest, 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 honest. What they've been trying to do, expand the tax base and get the dishonest. And the key to that is information and AI and all of that. So it's part of a broader strategy, not just an election strategy.
Do you think that, you know, there's been a lot of discussion around renewable energy, trying to make that more of an attractive sort of sector to go into? You know, how much of this is a legitimate attempt to try and sort out our energy issues? And how much of this is also just, I don't know, maybe just trying to be trendy and trying to fit in with, you know, the global conversation around being green and being sustainable and all these good things?
Well, actually, there's a mix. I think that the commissioner originally was pushing for renewable energy because he's concerned that if we don't have enough energy sources, ultimately he's going to make less revenue. So the big push on his side was, we want to make it cheaper. We know that people have to invest in renewables and all these alternatives to ESCOM, but we just want to make it cheaper so more people can do it. That was really his goal. The Treasury started getting into the politics of green and all of this, and they ended up giving incentive last year, which really was not that great. It was more, you know, flash than substance. And I'm not sure if it really did very much. So, you know, the income tax rebate, look, the bottom line is, can you afford a 200,000 Rand solar investment? The fact that you get maybe 20 or 10 or a certain amount back, it's still unaffordable for you. So it really isn't that effective. And then the business incentive one, which could have been more effective, that would have given you a higher investment deduction for buying it, is limited to 2 years, in that you have to bring the production into use on that solar or that renewable energy in 2 years. And all the big projects take more than 2 years to get off the ground. So there's been a lot of complaint that they should have changed the rules to make sure that people were making the investment now, but that they don't have to get it going until they're able to get it going. So they, to me, the Treasury one turned out to be more flash than substance. I think they were very afraid of the budget costs, but I think it overwhelmed. So they, I'm not really sure what they're doing there. It ended up being more flash. That's right. The end of that.
Well, I'm talking to Professor Keith Engels. He's the CEO of the South African Institute of Taxation. We're chatting about Budget Speech 2024 coming up in the next couple of days and what that will mean for your pocket, for my pocket, for the country's outlook, and also obviously in the build-up to the elections. It's going to be an interesting one. We're going to take a quick break, and more of Budget 2024 right after this.
You're listening to the Santon Times Hour. Connect with the Santon Times. Email editor at santontimes.co.za.
All right, I'm back with Professor Keith Engel, CEO of the South African Institute of Taxation. We're chatting about Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana's big decision, big announcement this week in terms of what's happening with South Africa's budget for 2024. And we've been touching on some of the hot topics, I suppose, some of the interesting questions that people are asking themselves ahead of the budget. But Professor Keith, it's an interesting year as well, because South African corporates have also been taking immense strain. I mean, load shedding has just been one of those things that I think the government has wished would just disappear with the wave of a wand, but it just tends to get worse before it gets better. And obviously that's impacted businesses across the board. I mean, probably small to medium-sized businesses more than even the bigger ones. And it's meant having to bring in more investment into alternative energy sources. In some instances, businesses have closed down, which means that they can't pay the necessary taxes that they would have paid if they were profitable and prospering, along with obviously people being employed and those people paying their fair share of pay as you earn. What is the solution to this? I mean, where do you even start to try and fix this all up?
Well, I think the problem is there's the strategy: can I keep squeezing people for what they don't have, or do I get some growth? And the problem is this government is not very good at the growth formula. So one, basic services. So electricity is an obvious one. Look at Transnet. There's a big issue there on the rails, on the roads. All of these basic services has been very poor. This government keeps getting weaker and weaker on those basic services. And they say, well, it's a business thing or whatever, but it's slowing the economy down. Our ports aren't what they should be, and now people are looking for alternatives. So that's part one of their problem. The problem is capital investment and all those things is expensive. So the only place I've suggested before is that government is also over-regulating. Government wants to regulate everything. They don't trust the private sector, and so they just regulate wherever they can. And that means everything you do needs approvals. But then if you need approvals, you need people to provide those approvals. And again, we don't have enough people to do that. So what you find is that this overregulation is killing what we have. And to deregulate is cheap. I'm not saying go crazy, but if the government deregulated and eased things up a little bit, you might find that the private sector has more room to maneuver. Even this thing about ESCOM, about privatization, look how long. We've been talking about it since 2017. Yeah. And yet we still haven't done it. So you need to privatize and you need to let go. That the government can do, but the government likes control. That's a problem.
Yeah. Do you foresee that there could be a reduction in the corporate income tax then to try and stimulate investment or businesses to remain going or actually start up in some way or another?
I don't see it because I don't think they can afford it. Mm. And in their mind, they don't think, well, if I lower my corporate rate, am I going to get more growth? And to be honest with you, lowering the corporate rate will not get the growth. 1 or 2% change won't change it. The problems that are hindering our growth is not the Minister of Finance. It's all of the other departments who are really anti-business and are over-regulating. Mm. And until you change that, that's what changed the growth formula.
There's always been a discussion around small to medium-sized enterprises. And I think every single year, it seems to be the one sector that keeps getting left out of the tax conversation or the budget conversation. Is how do you stimulate small to medium-sized businesses? And if you look at like an economy like Germany, where I think majority of the companies are family-owned, they're small to medium-sized businesses that have become bigger businesses, that seems to be the lifeblood of creating jobs as well, because corporate South Africa can also only create so many more jobs. I mean, the existing JSE-listed companies are also at a point where they might be able to increase by a fraction. But to really create new business and new jobs, it's up to that man on the street who decides to open a furniture shop or a fruit shop or a boutique hotel.
Generally, it's always popular to support small business and medium businesses. Politically, if you were on the left, it's about little people. On the right, it's about growth. So everybody can always agree small business is a great thing. Now, what is good about small business is it is a lot of times more employment creating than some big factory. So they tend to be more service oriented and all of that. So yes, there is a definite need for that. But that's when you actually are looking at the questions like load shedding. Now, here you are load shedding. So one of the problems we've had is since COVID, we've said, okay, work from home. But now if you're working from home, you don't have electricity. So if you're going to focus on them, you've got to focus on the basic services. The other area that's always coming for small business is the ability to get finance. And that is always a question. It's not about getting a ton of finance, but a bit of finance. And the question is, how do you provide finance in such a way that it isn't too risky? Mm. And that's always the second lever of it. But again, too, the other thing about small businesses, again, small, it's municipal regulations. Are you making the municipal regulations too tight? Are you making, again, I just want to make a small change to my property. I need another approval. You don't want people to go through those. So you can lighten those loads up. And then the last issue is education. Mm. Unfortunately, you know, people who have education are more likely to create those new jobs and create those new businesses. And we're not doing well on that front, on that education side. We're lowering our standards in order to improve our numbers. But so it's some, they're not, there's no quick fix, but it's going to be a series of combinations.
Yeah. I mean, what are your hopes and dreams for budget 2024? If you had a couple of things that you could tick off in terms of what the results would be, what would those look like?
Look, if I was going to help on and to be realistic, I think the biggest thing is basically stay the course, don't make too many changes. If you want, if it would be nice to give individual tax relief for people, some form, either, you know, adjusting the brackets or something like that, that would help. I think that would be all that's realistically possible. And then two, please don't raise any taxes when it comes to NHI. The NHI really is yet another burden on the system. And if you start raising taxes for that, please, that would be a real problem.
Well, we wait and see what Enoch Gonagwana is going to pull out of the proverbial hat or out of the suitcase or whatever it is that he's going to be arriving with at Budget Day 2024. Professor Keith Engel, CEO of the South African Institute of Taxation, joining me there to chat about what will happen this week. And I suppose there's going to be a whole other conversation after the budget has been announced to see what came to life and what didn't and how that's going to impact the vote in a couple of months' time. We're going to take a quick musical break and more of the Sand Times Hour right after this.
Back for more?
The Sand Times Hour continues.
Welcome to the second half of the Sand Times Hour on Mix 93.8. I'm Alexander Leipner, and that was Rule the World. It's a remake by Tiësto along with Tears for Fears, Nico and Sway and Goodfella. If you caught something intriguing on the show this week, if you want to get some more information on what we discussed, well, all the details are up on the Sandton Times. You can go to sandtontimes.co.za and explore this week's show notes, and there you'll get a breakdown, some of the highlights of this week's edition, and of course, further reading and links of all that you heard and so much more. And also, don't forget, you can connect with the Sandton Times at Sandton Times on all your favorite social media platforms. And also don't forget to engage on there. If you'd like to get in touch, you can email, message, DM, voice note, whatever you prefer. Over the last week, we heard about the entrance of a new food outlet called Prêt-à-Manger. Prêt-à-Manger being French for ready to eat. It's a British sandwich shop franchise. If you've traveled overseas, I recently traveled through Heathrow and saw a Prêt-à-Manger there in London, and that's where it originated back in the 80s, and it's popularly referred to as Prêt. And here to chat to me about this entrance is Hamza Farouki. He's the CEO of Millet Group. And Hamza, it's good to have you on the Sandton Times Hour.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hamza, let's talk about this entrance of Prêt-à-Manger. What motivated the expansion of the brand into the South African market, and why at this stage?
Millet as an organization over the last number of years has been working very hard in creating a space and a category around food, beverage, hospitality experiences. And that manifests itself into what we've done within the hotel space, into our growth within the convenience space. And the food and beverage and food service category is one which we've always believed is one which has huge growth opportunity. And not to say that there aren't enough entrants, but I think the ability to deliver a better experience, the ability to deliver focus on ingredients, great customer centricity, and we really found significant alignment with those brands and those values in the Prêt brand. And that's why we were of view and that this could be created in South Africa in a meaningful fashion. And we went out, we built a great relationship with them, we got to know them, we got to know what the brand stands for. We're very excited that we're bringing this to South Africa. But more than just the brand, I think what the brand represents, because many people bring brands, and that's the easy part. The more challenging part is to find the cultural alignment, and how do you create that link to the consumer? And that's really what the Prêt story for us at Millet is about.
I think you've raised a very interesting point there. I mean, we've seen a lot of international entrances, and I mean, I'm not going to go through the whole list, but I mean, Dunkin' Donut, we've had Popeyes that have entered, we've had a whole bunch of other brands that have come in over the last while. Some of them have managed to make it work somehow, others have not made it. Have there been any learnings that you've taken out of these? Have you observed what they've done right and maybe not done right and said, well, you know, there's something that we can take to make this entrance work a little bit better?
Of course, I think there's lots of learnings, and we'd be foolish not to learn. But I think for us, what's very different is we've adopted a very different approach on how we see global brands and the entry into new geographies. And people get sort of caught up in the euphoria of a global brand. For us, it's about curating, localizing, and making a link with what the global brand stands for with the South African consumer. So us, it's not so much about the brand, but what does that brand stand for and how do we make that connection with the South African consumer? Global brands exist because they want to make connections with consumers, not because they bring you ready-made market access. And that's the opportunity set. That's the mindset of what Millet as an organization does. So bringing brands are easy, right? Everyone brings brands. You know, there's lots of brands. But how do I create meaningful connections with my consumer? How do I curate? How do I make sure that I am locally relevant? How do I make sure price point, affordability, quality, all of those pieces stack in and I make the brand locally relevant? And people abuse this word often, and I don't like the word because it smacks of sort of authenticity. But being glocal, I think, is in a way what's fairly an easy way to explain what I'm saying.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. A question about the selection process now, which is obviously underway now to find the right sites, because I suppose that's also part of the business mix, is to make sure that you're in the right place at the right time and making sure the distribution is right. Greater Sandton, you've already got a bit of a footprint there in terms of your hospitality businesses. Is that potentially sort of a first entrance point for this new brand?
I think Sandton as a node is always going to be relevant. I think in the South African context, what Sandton represents, what it stands for, the kind of development. I know my friends in Cape Town won't entirely always agree with me, but I think, Sandton is and will remain, I think, a very important node and hub for where our country is in many respects. So I think that always has to be part of a development strategy. But I think there's other exciting nodes as well. I think the South African consumer is becoming more and more aware. People are looking at different choices. Different times of days and weeks and hours are being spent in different areas. You know, with the kind of growth, urbanization, staying patterns of consumers aren't now relevant to just certain nodes. They're able to access multiple spaces. So we're looking at different areas, but it's basically going to be high-level retail, transient, and we have a shortlist, but we are being very careful about where we go first, and that's why we haven't rushed to make an announcement to say that's the first store. And I think we're doing it also with the intention of some scale and not just one store with a long queue for 3 months and then you have a hiatus for a while. We want to sort of go in a couple of options, give the customers lots of choice, lots of customer centricity, and really build the true Pret experience.
Yeah. I mean, Pret prides itself on doing fresh sandwiches, salads, and a range of different hot beverages. That's what they've become known for around the world. Do you foresee any adaptation of that coming into the South African market? Are there any unique challenges or unique opportunities that you think might lend itself to doing something a little bit different in country?
I think we're going to be very focused on local ingredients. We are blessed, South Africa as a country, to have access to great quality, fresh ingredients. So I think finding the best of those ingredients, building that into the supply chain process, but also curating some of the items. You know, I think we're very blessed with great meats, great sort of fresh produce, and we're going to be making sure there is a local adaptation. So whilst it's very much positioned as a great British classic brand, and there's some great sort of classics which everyone loves, you know, from the oats to the cucumber sandwiches, but I think there's going to be a strong local component catered to a localized palate, which will also continuously evolve and develop, because we want people like variety, people like a change in taste. And I think all of those things are going to be on offer as we build scale in the Pret offering.
Well, there you have it. Pret a Manger coming to South Africa, and I'm going to be watching this quite carefully, seeing when the first one opens, and obviously also going to be trying it out. CEO Hamza Faruqi, they have Millet Group, who will be leading this into South Africa. Thank you for making the time to be on the Sandton Times Hour.
From Greater Sandton to the rest of the world, this is the Sandton Times Hour.
Well, change of pace is always as we do at this time of the show. And the Old Mutual Insure 2024 Car of the Year is fast approaching. They've announced their finalists in this year's edition of the award. And it's probably one of South Africa's more prestigious car awards, where an expert panel of jurors sit down, they deliberate, they discuss, people who deal with cars and motor vehicles their entire year long, and decide, you know, which cars are the ones that really stand out, that really should be awarded a title in this competition. And here to chat to me is one of the jurors. He's Alan Rosenmeyer, publisher of Motor Matters. And Alan, it's good to have you on the Santon Times Hour.
Thank you, Alex. Great to be here with you.
Well, Alan, let's get into this. I mean, we've discussed this in previous years. We've managed to catch up with different jurors talking about the car of the year. But from your perspective, what makes this competition so prestigious and also so important in terms of the motoring industry, but also of in terms of people who are wanting to buy cars?
There's a lot of history to COTI, as we call it. Okay. South African COTI, Car of the Year, which is owned by the SA Guild of Mobility Journalists, the Guild. It's one of the oldest competitions in the world right now. I think it's, I speak under correction, 38 or 39 years now. So it's been around for a long time, and it's been refined over the years. There's been a lot of work put into the system. It's one of the most comprehensive car award programs actually in the world. The jury do not sit around and deliberate. We actually have testing evaluation days, which are coming up at the beginning of March. Now, this is the exciting part. I speak under correction. We are the only or one of the only Car of the Year in the world that does physical evaluation of the cars there and then for the award. It's a massive undertaking to get this together.
That is quite a critical part as well, because I think it's one thing sort of sitting down with fact sheets and kind of, I remember that old card game where you could kind of compare cars and say, you know, mine's faster than yours, or mine's got more sort of Newton horsepower or whatever, versus actually getting into the car and experiencing it and seeing kind of, you know, what is the lived experience versus the, you know, the fact sheets.
Well, that's the thing, you know. So on the first afternoon, we're going to sit down and have a training session, because the scoring is you are given a book, not even pages, okay, a score book with every car and certain criteria listed on each car. I'm just, for example, and you score from 1 to 10 on each of these items. It'll be acceleration. It'll be road holding. So a lot of them are factual, how you feel. Then a lot of them are your impression of the car, which is also just as important. I mean, even down to, is it value for money within its category?
Right, right.
And we part, there's a lot of work done by the organization Lightstone, who put together a lot of the comparative information. And for example, the biggest thing is you've got to be comparing every finalist with not a Mini with a Mercedes-Benz. You are comparing it with its peers in its category.
Right.
Otherwise, wouldn't a Rolls-Royce win the competition every year if there was one in it, you know?
Well, maybe not on fuel consumption, but they might win on a couple of other things. But yeah, or practicality. Yeah. I mean, much like a Porsche might not be your first choice when you're going shopping at Makro.
Correct, yeah. So yeah, these are all important factors as well, and they brought into it as well. The first is the training session, where they just want everyone to understand how the scoring works. It's important there's some new jurors, et cetera, et cetera. Day two is the day where we take the cars to Swartkopf Raceway. And we evaluate every car around the track. And the 4x4s, for example, we take on the 4x4 track. So even a small Econobox entry-level car, you want to feel how it handles around a track.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that is important. But in the context of its competitors, of its market placement. So that's day two. And the other thing is just remember that especially, you know, that Car of the Year for the last couple of years has now had categories. It's not just one. There is an overall Car of the Year, but there are also category winners.
Yeah, Alan, I wanted to get into those categories because I think that's going to be, I think, quite an interesting point. So you've got budget and compact, compact and family or family. Then you've got premium, luxury, 4x4 double cab, where I see you've got one finalist. So I suppose is that sort of a given that that particular car ends up winning, or not necessarily?
Well, there's an interesting thing here where obviously it wins, but it's not necessarily awarded the title unless it scores above a certain benchmark.
Okay, got you. All right. Okay, so that still needs to happen. Then you've got Adventure SUV, and then you've got Performance, which has got actually probably the most finalists, I think, in all the categories. But
there are four there. Yeah,
there's four in there. I think I've driven one or two of them, but we'll touch on that briefly just now. In terms of across the categories, is there anyone that particularly, and I suppose maybe you can't show any bias here, but is there anything that you particularly noticed in terms of the finalists this year? You know, anything that stands out in terms of the cars that have been released over the last year?
Let me rephrase that if I can.
Yeah.
The previous 2 years, and this is really a personal opinion, I'm sticking my neck out slightly. The previous 2 years, there's almost been a bit of a no-brainer as to who would win.
Right.
And I know a lot of people were shocked at the Ford Ranger winning last year as a Bucky, but let me tell you, I rated it this day one. This year, I don't have outright favorite at this point.
Interesting. Okay, so it's down to the evaluation and really the details that'll probably tip it in one way or the other.
100%. Yeah. Yeah. I've driven probably 60 to 70% of the finalists.
Yeah.
Which is a fair ratio. I can't give you exact. It's in that range. But there are a few I haven't yet, which is a pity. And just driving it for a few laps on evaluation day, I would love to get a chance to drive it more than that. But look, that's how it works. And can I just jump quickly before you go further? Day three, we do get the chance to road drive the cars, not necessarily all of them. But if there's certain ones you want to, you can do that. So you can then at least get that chance as well and to evaluate the car a bit more.
Okay, fantastic.
Before you sit down with your final scoring.
Okay, tremendous. Well, we've got the full list of all the finalists up on the Santon Times website. If you want to go have a look at that, you can have, you know, and we'll also keep you up to date as to how the evaluation goes. Alan Rosenmeier, publisher of Motor Matters. He's one of the jurors of the Old Mutual Insure 2024 Car of the Year finalists. Thank you for making the time to be on the Santon Times Hour. We're going to take a quick musical break and more of the hour right after this.
Online, on air,
anywhere, anytime.
This is the Santon Times Hour.
This is the Santon Times Hour on Mix 93.8. And as we head into the final minutes of this week's show, that was Texas. Haven't heard from them in such a long time, but a great song, Texas with Inner Smile. Ending where we started with a little romance in our songs this week, and talking about Inner Smile, I headed to Rosebank this week for an Outer Smile as the details of the Laugh Africa Comedy Festival were revealed, and I grabbed a few minutes with accomplished comedian and creative director of the Laugh Africa Comedy Festival, Stuart Taylor, to get some more details, and I kicked off our chat by asking him what the festival was all about.
Laugh Africa Comedy Festival, 3 days of comedy for the comedy connoisseur. It's at the Sandton Convention Center, and I have put together a lineup that is encompassing of all our types of comedy. I've got Afrikaans comics, I've got Fnac comics, I've got English-speaking comics, we've got a roast, we've got social media comics, all in one space. That's never been done before. These things are always compartmentalized. People are gonna be able to buy a festival pass, which gets you in there for the full day. You go to the roast, you go to the social media stage, you watch a bit over there, you go and grab a bite to eat, you head off to the Savannah bar, you then go into the comedy club space, after that, grab another Savannah, and then go into our big 3,000-seater auditorium and go and watch Eddie Griffin. Do you know what I mean? It's an incredible, incredible mishmash and lineup of all sorts of comedy styles, comedy flavors, and some of my favorite comedy acts. I mean, I've got Celeste Ntuli headlining Ladies Night. I've got Masha Bela headlining Mzansi's Finest with Tumi Morake on that lineup. I've got, as I said, at our gala shows, my support acts are people like Sifiso Nene, Eugene Koza, Alfred Adrian, and Dylan Oliphant. In the Laughter Unleashed show, I've got two-time Emmy-nominated comic Conrad Koch and Chester Missing with someone like Skumba. You know what I mean? It's this amazing mishmash of comedy if you're a comedy fan. 5 to 7 April, you need to put it in your diary. Savannah and Showmax are putting together a lineup second to none.
Is this kind of bringing South African comedy festivals in line with some of the stuff we see in Montreal, that we see in London, that we see in so many other international destinations?
That's exactly what it is. I remember one of the first big international festivals I was at was in Vegas. So we are at Caesar's Palace, and I was traveling solo. And there was never a single moment where I stood on my own, or I felt bored, or I felt out of sorts, because there was so much happening. There's this assault on your senses. And I want to give that experience to comedy lovers. You're going to come, you walk to the fourth floor, there's Showmax activations, there are Savannah photo booths, there's a bit of beer pong happening over here, and then all of these shows that you have access to. So it's absolutely about taking some of the workings from our international festivals and bringing it back home here to home soil.
And why are you bringing it to Sandton specifically? What was the decision in terms of the location?
I think there's a prestige around the Sandton Convention Center that, you know, it still lives as a wow place when you say, oh, you know, the festival is at the Sandton Convention Center. It does hold a lot of weight. I'm laughing because I saw the invoice for what it costs. But it's central. It's that place. It's so central, and it can take many, many thousands of people without any pillars in the way. So there are other places you can get 3,000 people in a venue, but the pillars might give you some sightline issues. So a big, beautiful 3,000 seater with a chill out zone next to it, with a little comedy club space behind it, plus a second, that's on the fifth floor. On the fourth floor, just a cool place with all of these activations means that it's going to be more of a festival as opposed to, and I'm going to say, regular run-of-the-mill comedy show, which I love. I love regular run-of-the-mill comedy shows, but this we want to make kind of special.
There was the creative director of the Laugh Africa Comedy Festival, Stuart Taylor. He was hard-pressed to tell me ahead of time who was going to be the butt of the comedy roast, but I can now safely share with you that it is none other than Minnie Dlamini. And more details will be up on the Sandton Times website in due course about the roast, but also the festival as well. I think that's all we have time for on the show this week. That's the Sandton Times on Mix 93.8, always available on podcast platforms all over the world right after the show. So if you are on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, or any of the other platforms, you can subscribe and make sure it's part of your weekly listening digest. If you want to get in touch, you can email editor@sandtontimes.co.za, connect on the Sandton Times social media @SandtonTimes or /Sandton Times. And then you can also visit the website sandtontimes.co.za and feel free to send through your questions, your comments, your feedback. All of those things are welcome. And I see people have been making good use of sharing as much news, views, and information as they can. Thank you to all my guests who made the time to be on the show this week, as well as Vincenzo. Yeah, thanks again for the chocolate. Let's wrap up the show this week and play out with Paul Russell and Little Boo Thang. Thank you for listening, and let's do it again next week.